Today's April 7th, 2015. This is a joint committee on Ways and Means, subcommittee on Natural Resources. Today will be a continuation of the public hearing on House Bill 5042, Oregon Water Resources Department. Before we call up Director Beiler, I believe we're going to have a presentation by Mr. Whitman. But before we do that, I'll turn it over. Nope, nothing. So we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 5042 and call up Mr. Whitman.
Good morning, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Brown's Natural Resources Advisor. I'm going to do a very quick presentation to the committee this morning. And what I want to do is give you a high-level overview of the elements in the governor's proposed initiative around the Integrated Water Resources Program. The Integrated Water Resources Program, AKA the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, was adopted by the Oregon Water Resources Commission in August of 2013 after a several-year effort involving a broad range of interests and constituents to chart out the future of Oregon's water resources. And it has essentially three elements in the governor's recommended budget. One, funding for local prioritization of water resources projects and planning work. Two, funding for project development, and then three, funding for particular projects. Okay, next slide. Or not.
What did we do, Lisa?
Those watching on live television, we're having a little technical difficulties at this time.
So, committee, while we're waiting for that, just a little explanation about this presentation. I am going to talk a little bit about the specific funding packages, but what I really wanted to do today was provide you with context for why such a big funding package was proposed by the governor on this issue. And I'm going to start with this slide, which was taken from the Oregonian on March 30th, just about a week ago. And there have been a series of articles in both the Oregonian and, for those who read the New York Times, also a series of articles in the New York Times about drought in the western United States. So next slide. So I wanted to give you a quick update of where we're at on drought. Here you can see the western United States, the darker red area is the most extreme level of drought you can see in California, in Nevada. And then the next most extreme level reaches up into southern and eastern Oregon. Next slide. The outlook for the rest of this year. This is the three-month outlook for temperature. You can see that we're looking at the long-range forecast for the western United States is significantly above average temperatures continuing for the next 3 months. Next slide. And then precipitation, not any better. The long-range three-month forecast for precipitation in western Oregon is also significantly below average, particularly in the northwestern portion of the state, but also the remainder of the western portion of the state.
And Mr. Whitman, could you go back one slide? And
yeah, absolutely.
What do those colors represent on the one more slide forward? Oh, no, no,
the other direction.
One more, that one. What do those colors represent?
These are levels of probability of either above or below average precipitation in this case.
And so if I'm reading that correctly, and I do need glasses, yeah. It says so, B, is that, and that means below precipitation?
Below average, precipitation. And so the darker brown is significantly below, and the lighter brown is just below average.
And what is the EC, what does that mean?
That means normal, equal chance of either above or below.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, next slide. So this next slide is the Willamette Basin in Oregon, and it's a little hard to read, but it's these diagrams show the level of fill of reservoirs in the Willamette Basin. So these are primarily U.S. Army Corps of Engineers projects in the Willamette. Elsewhere in the state, we have mainly Bureau of Reclamation reservoirs or private reservoirs, and you'll see the fill levels in the reservoirs range around one-third is the total average for the basin, going from about 55% down to significantly lower than that in some areas of the basin.
And at this time of the year, where are we usually as far as fill?
This is percentage of normal.
Percentage
so
of
this
normal.
Is in the Willamette Basin, we're at about a third of normal in terms of storage in our reservoir systems. Next slide. So I've given you a little bit of context about why this is an issue. Obviously, last fall, we couldn't have predicted that we were going to have a third, really fourth year of continuing drought, but here we are. This is the new normal, and Oregon needs to start preparing for it. So the governor's recommended budget proposes just over $50 million to start working with communities around water resource issues. We don't have $7.5 billion bond measure like the state of California just passed overwhelmingly with support of its voters. But nevertheless, we need to get started, and there are things we can do for less money. This is not all about investing in new storage facilities, although that's some of what we believe some communities will want and need to do. Just like in the electric utility field, much of the least cost supply in terms of water resources is in terms of conservation and efficiency. And there are many low-cost things we as Oregonians can do to stretch our existing supplies. And that's where a lot of people are likely going to start. Next slide. So you'll see if once you break down what California is spending its $7.5 billion on, $2.7 billion on new storage, but also significant amounts on recycling, on groundwater sustainability, which has been in the papers regarding California recently, and then system reliability. So they're also spending significant amounts, not just on storage, but conservation and efficiency. Next slide. So this is my last slide, and it's just a summary of the budget packages around the Integrated Water Resources Program. There is funding for staffing at the department to work with local communities to develop their own priorities for what makes sense for those particular communities in terms of water resources, whether that be a new storage facility above or below ground, or conservation or efficiency. Or another thing that I have not talked about is issues in terms of our environment. So up in the state of Washington, which by the way has approved over $200 million for water resources projects, they are helping fund projects to keep water in stream to help their fisheries during these very dry periods, in addition to funding projects for farmers and for municipalities to stretch their water supplies. So staffing for the state to gear up to start to work with local communities to address these challenges. But then particularly at the bottom here, the bond package. So planning grants, feasibility grants, and then actually project finance pieces as well. Again, it's over a $50 million package. We know this is a significant investment for the state in times of tight budgets. But as you saw in the context that I provided, we believe strongly we need to get going on this issue. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Whitman. We'll go ahead and call up Director Byler.
Mr. Chair. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Beiler, the director of the Oregon Water Resources Department. Today, I want to continue the presentation on our budget, before I start in on that, I want to do a quick follow-up on a line of questions that we had from Representative Gomberg and Senator Hansel regarding our commission members and the status and replacement of that. And one area that I wasn't clear on is what happens when if a member leaves early before their term expires, what flexibility do we have in terms of filling that position? What we've learned is in our statutes is that we are required that the next person who fills that position will serve out the remainder of that term. And I was a little squishy on that yesterday, so I wanted to follow up on that point to make sure that that you have that information.
Yes, Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Director.
Good morning.
It seems then somehow we've gotten a little out of whack if we've got four-year terms and we've only got terms expiring in two of those 4 years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg, I wasn't around during this time period, but my sense is that, and my experience has been, and not just with this commission, is that there are times when it's difficult to fill positions when their terms expire, just because of the politics around the situation. And we've had in the past, on this commission and other boards and commissions with state agencies, we've had some members who have stuck around longer than the terms that they were intending to serve. In our statutes, commissioners are intended to serve no more than two consecutive terms, but we have had instances where we've asked folks to hang on a little bit longer while we've worked through the process of getting those folks replaced.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Out of whack is a technical term.
It is.
All right. So again, thank you and good morning. It's good to be back to talk about our budget. This morning we're shifting into Chapter 3 of the presentation, which involves process improvements. And at the outset, I want to just take a minute. As I mentioned yesterday, I still feel pretty new to the agency. I started about 6 months ago. And one of the things that I brought forward are some really key principles that I've communicated to staff and will continue to communicate with staff as we want to make sure that we build this into our culture and our philosophy and how we operate. And there are some very basic elements to that. One is good communication, both internally between ourselves as staff and externally in terms of how we talk and work with folks and making sure that we're communicating effectively. Also interested in fair and transparent processes. As we implement our programs. And we want to have an ethic of problem solving, creative problem solving, when there's not a lack of issues and challenges for us in that regard in this arena. And we want to have efficient and effective processes. So all those bundled together, I think, fit well with the key performance measures that we have that are really designed to help us track our progress in carrying out our functions and carrying out our mission and our responsibilities as an agency. And I can tell you that I've been very pleased upon coming into the department because I feel like many of those principles are part of the daily business model that folks have in mind as they go about their functions. And as an example, I'll talk a little bit about some of the things that the department has been doing in addition to our key performance measure work. But before I do that, I just want to give a broad overview of our key performance measures in very briefly. We have 14 key performance measures. Nine of those key performance measures are oriented around measuring our progress around our water management functions. Whether it's looking at in-stream flows or data collection or our regulatory actions. The remaining five are really built around customer service. So you'll see that as we walk through those. We are doing a pretty good job on our key performance measures. In 2013, we had about 65% of our key performance measures were within about 5% of the target that we had. In 2014, we were able to bump that up to 78% within 5%. So that's that's good as an overall trend. But as you'll see, we have some areas where we're doing well and other areas where we need to improve. And so I'll step you through those in some detail as we move forward. But first, I'd like to spend just a few minutes on some measures and actions that the agency has underway or has taken upon itself to improve processes that are above and beyond our key performance measures. One of those items is what we call our weekly notice, and it is just that. Every week we send out a notice that involves key information for the water user community about applications and different water transactions that we have, and we have many different water transactions that we're responsible for with our programs. And this becomes a very important document for the water user community to understand what's going on on a regular basis. That weekly notice has, over the years, taken a fair bit of time to compile every week for our staff. And what we did this biennium is our Water Rights Services Division worked with our Technical Services Division, and we developed some tools, essentially, information technology tools, to help the staff who pulled together that information to shave off a couple hours a week around pulling that information together. And while that may not seem like a big deal, that does add up over time, and it does create some opportunity for those staff hours to be applied to other areas, which is important for us, and we need to look for those opportunities where we can find them. Another area that I wanted to share with you is an effort that we have underway with customer service SharePoint. And essentially with that, we are pulling together at our reception desk. We often have folks come in off the street and with questions and information requests. And what we're doing now is collecting the range of questions that we get from folks and the answers that we provide for them. With the idea of pulling together a sense of, are there questions that we receive more frequently than others? This will lead to, ultimately, our being able to produce an FAQ, a frequently asked questions list, with some answers that will be there and readily available. This could be useful for a lot of our folks or a lot of our customers and the public because, one, they'll be able to access this on the internet and have access to a lot of information that we know that the public asks for on a regular basis. Two, it'll be available if someone comes by our office. Our staff will have that at their fingertips. They won't have to research the question. They'll have that there for them. And three, it's going to be good for our staff as we bring new people on board. There's going to be some really key information there, some very basic building block information that will be good for our institutional memory, but also to make sure that our staff, as they come in new, have access to information that's going to be very useful to them as they interface with the public at large. The next bullet there involves Lean Kaizen, and if you're familiar with Lean Kaizen, it is a process. It's a process that helps businesses, whether in the public or private sector, to improve efficiency in how we do our work. And it's something that that I'm familiar with in my time at the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, where I was previous to this position. And the Water Resources Department has been using this model to improve and create efficiencies in the processing of its programs and different work that we have in different areas of the agency. I'm a big fan of this. I think it's an important thing to do. I know what it's like to not do this, and I've been in situations where folks know that we need to do a better job, and so what do? Well, everyone just works harder, right? Well, that's not necessarily the most efficient and effective way to do things. With the Lean Kaizen process, it affords you an opportunity to take a step back, take a look at and to deconstruct the processes that you're using and kind of look at those with fresh eyes and find ways to improve. So this is something that the agency's been using for a number of years. It's helped us to make some improvements. Within this current biennium, we've used this process to help make some improvements to our in-stream leasing program and allocation of conserved water program. We've also used this process to make some improvements on backlog reduction for some of our other programs. and I believe I mentioned this briefly yesterday, but I'll mention this again. We have some backlog issues with respect to some of our water transactions. For example, certificates, the claim of beneficial use that a permit holder will make in order to be able to get a certificate water right, which is the goal of any water right holder. Back in 2003, we had a backlog of over 6,000 applications in the queue. Not a good situation for anybody. And through a series of improvements, including lean Kaizen process and information technology improvements, we're now have whittled that down to about 2,000 applications. Obviously, we still have some work to do, but we're definitely headed in the right direction, and I'm pleased with the improvements that we've been able to make there. Similarly, with our transfers program, back in 2004, we had a backlog of over 700 pending applications, and we've now whittled that down to about 250, again, applying some of these same principles of process improvements. So those are good news and good progress. We still have a ways to go. We're going to continue to use this philosophy and these approaches to look for continuous improvement in how we operate.
Mr. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Director, if this is part of a presentation you're getting to later, let me know and I'll hold off. But looking through your online applications and other forms, what I noted is virtually all of them are available as a PDF download. And I presume what happens then is the end user makes a copy of that, fills it out, and mails it into you with a check. And I'm wondering if that's the most efficient process, both in terms of your own staff time as well as the time used by the applicant, and whether you're looking forward to a point where you can have these forms available online and electronic processing of the payments rather than doing it all with paper.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg, we've had those conversations, and my goal is to move us in the direction that you just stated. When I was at OWEB, we were moving away from paper and moving towards electronic applications. We've been doing that in some of our areas, but we haven't really tackled that in some of our bigger program areas, and I think that's a need for us. Our payments issue might be a little bit more complicated because our fee structures can be pretty complex. So that's something we'll have to take a hard look at. But at a minimum, I think being able to digitize our applications will be a savings not only for the customer but also for ourselves. It will create some opportunity for us to expedite our programs and the review of these applications.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to move into the key performance measures. Key performance measure number one involves flow restoration, and here we're on target. This is a measure that looks at the percent of watersheds that had in-stream flows added where needed for fish. As you can see, that we've either been exceeding or on target for a number of years. This is really asking the question, are folks using our programs, in-stream leasing, and permanent transfers for in-stream purposes, allocation of conserved water? These are the programs that that can result in protected flows for ecological values. And Oregon is really out in front compared to most Western states around this issue. And it's taken some time, quite honestly. As I mentioned yesterday, the state didn't even recognize the ability for us to be able to protect in-stream flows until the late 1980s. And it's been a bit of a work in progress in terms of gaining some comfort level with the water user community to even entertain doing a temporary lease to in-stream purposes, let alone a permanent transfer. But as you can see here, we are making progress along those lines. To date, we've had over 1,000 in-stream leases around the state, about 350 transfers for in-stream purposes, are as a result of that, we're able to protect a lot of additional water in-stream for valuable fish-related and in-stream purposes.
And are these each year as we're looking at that? Is that 25% in the year or 24%, or is that include? Is that like cumulative over time, where we're just maintaining?
I believe it's year by year, but I'm going to cast my head back here and And I'm not seeing any head nodding or any kind of conclusive remark. Why don't we follow up with you on that? I believe it's year to year in terms of how
that's
the percent of watersheds.
Yeah, yeah, I just want to make sure.
Okay. Protection of in-stream water rights. Here, you'll note we're not meeting the target, but the idea here is of what's the ratio of streams that the state is protecting in-stream values, in-stream water rights, compared to all the streams that we regulate around the state. And what's notable here is that unlike all other water rights, in-stream water rights are held by the state. And as a result, we don't have a farmer or a rancher or a municipality out in different parts of the state knocking on the water master's door to say, protect my water right. Instead, it's the state, ourselves, our own staff, really have the responsibility for tracking the need to be able to distribute water in favor of these rights where the instance arises. It's something we take very seriously. It's something that the data and information that we collect becomes extremely important for us to be able to understand whether stream flows are being met where there are in-stream water rights. So it's something that our staff carry with them in their day-to-day business. In this case, one of the challenges we have in terms of meeting this is that we can't control the demand that we would have in any given year to regulate streams. And in this case, in 2013, we had a busy year. It was a dry year. And as a result, we had about 100 more streams that we regulated than we had in the previous year. And as it turns out, a number of those streams did not have in-stream water rights on them to begin with. And so that had a lot to do with influencing the number that you see there and why we dipped down from the past. I would say that, though, that we're, I feel that we're well within the target range. And again, it continues to be a priority area for us.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, Tom, the years where the bar exceeds the goals, and there are some, real examples of that, are those wetter years? Is that what happened in those years? Do you know?
Well, I think that in those years we were a couple things were happening. One, we were doing a good job of regulating. Our target was a lot lower back in those days, of course, which helps us to exceed, and our targets has increased over the years. I would say that what you're seeing here is a bit of a learning curve on our part in terms of our attention to this effort, and that as you see those numbers increase, you're seeing that we're doing a better job of focusing on regulating on behalf of those in-stream water rights.
And just to make sure that I understand the ratio is correct, for every one stream that is regulated, there's 0.75 streams that are regulated to protect in-stream water. Am I understanding
that's
that
correct.
Correctly?
That's
so
correct.
A one-to-one would be for every one stream regulated, there's one that we're protecting the in-stream water rights.
If we regulated 100 streams in a year, and under this, 75 of those would have had in-stream water rights that we were protecting.
Okay. Just making sure I understand.
Okay. Okay. Performance measure number 3, monitoring compliance. Here we're looking at the total regulatory actions that found water right holders were in compliance with their water rights or with water law in general. And this is an important element for us, and I'll talk about this more in a related performance measure in terms of our staff presence. But for us, it's really, there are 80,000 surface water rights, 250 wells around the state, and we have 54 field staff. And so, we're not omnipresent on any given year on every stream. And it makes it challenging from a regulatory standpoint for us to be able to carry out the distribution of water based on priority. But the thing that helps us out a lot is good communication and awareness among the water user community. And when we have that good communication and awareness, what we find, by and large, is that water users comply with the terms of their water rights and with the basic principles of distribution of water. And so for us, when you look at these numbers here, and we're just slightly below the target here on this item, you know, if we're achieving in the high 90s percent in terms of compliance, that's good news for us. That helps a lot because, again, we don't have enough staff out there to be looking around every corner and walking every stream. So this is an important area for us, and I think it reflects the success that we've been having in working with the water user community. This is something that happens over a long period of time as well. This is where the Water Master develops relationships with the water users over time. What we find is that water users begin to understand where they are within the priority system on the rivers that they are, and in any given water year, as they pay attention to whether it's going to be a dry year or not, they'll have a general sense of when they, how long they'll be able to use water over that period of time. And we certainly welcome them to talk to our staff to help kind of get refine that understanding. So if a water right holder and a junior water right holder in Eastern Oregon has, on a good water year, may find themselves getting shut off maybe in early September. In a bad water year, when it's really dry, they may expect to get shut off in August. And having that communication and that experience over time, they'll be able to plan around that and understand the limits of their water right based on the system. Key performance measure number four, it relates to stream gauging. This is the measurement of surface water flows. And here, the charge under this performance measure is to measure the percent change from 2001 in the number of department-operated or assisted gauging stations. And here we're meeting our target. We've exceeded that 2001 number by 7%. In 2001, we had 215 stream gauging stations around the state. Today, we have 231. That's good news. The reality of this performance measure is really based on whether we have resources or not, to be blunt. We need money to be able to purchase and install stream gauging stations, and we need resources to be able to maintain them over time, staff resources in terms of collecting the data, making sure that those stream gauging stations are functioning properly, and then, of course, assessing the data that we collect. So our success in this is dependent upon on our ability to be able to have resources to be able to continue to add to the number of stream gauging stations that we have around the state. A similar performance measure, KPM-5, involves assessing groundwater resources. And here we're looking at the percent of change from 2001 in the number of wells that are routinely monitored to assess groundwater resources. In 2001, we had 350 observation wells. These are wells where we routinely measure groundwater levels in different parts of the state. Today, we have 2,068, so we've increased by 18 in that time period. As you can see, we're not meeting the target that is laid out there. We are trending in the right direction, but much like the previous performance measure, our success in this arena is dependent upon having resources. In 2013, the legislature provided resources for us on this performance measure, as well as the last one, in terms of our giving us the ability to be able to purchase new stream gauges, and in this case, being able to go out and drill a number of new observation wells. So we're very grateful for that support. That's going to help us to understand, especially with groundwater, it's going to help us to understand a resource that in some areas of the state we absolutely need to get a better handle on in order to be able to understand what supply options folks have in those areas and to protect the users on those aquifers. So we're glad that we're able to move this in the right direction and hopeful that we'll be able to continue to move in that direction in the future. Key performance measure number six. This is a customer service related element for us, and it's also related to key performance measure number seven. And here we're looking at the percent of water management related data sets that the department pulls together that we make available to the public on our website. So again. Of the data that we collect, are we making that available for folks? The target here we're exceeding by a little bit, which is great. And it is important to us not just to collect the data and have it sit somewhere in our offices, but to make it useful for the public. And this performance measure is really set up to help measure our progress in that regard. The other piece of this is our people accessing that information. It's one thing to have it on the website, but are people making use of it? And here, this key performance measure number seven is looking at the number of times that water management-related data were accessed through the internet. And so it's just looking at the number of hits on key data sets that we have. And here we are exceeded our target. Target was 2.3 million hits over the course of the year, in 2014 in this case, and we had 2.39 million hits.
How many unique users did you have? Obviously, population, we're not 2.3 million people are clicking on this, so I'm kind of curious how many actually unique users are using the website. I'll start off with that.
Mr. Co-Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. We can look into that. I'm not sure if we track that information, but if we do, we can.
If you have that information, you have unique users.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Okay.
Representative Parrish.
Well, and to that, having run an internet company, that sounds really high for a government website.
Yeah.
I'll just be honest. I'd also be curious how much of that traffic is just bots, like Google's crawling your site, because that would show up as a hit every time they do that. So I'm going to question that number. I mean, this is an interesting metric. You know, are you reaching people? But I think you need to drill down a little deeper on that one.
Okay.
Some of the other things you'd want to look through is click-through rate, because what's the length of time? How many pages do they click when you're on the website? There's a whole list of metrics that you can see on Google Analytics that will kind of really help, you know, I guess better assess how people are using the information. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, I appreciate that advice, and we'll follow up based on that and get back to you tomorrow with any additional information we have on that. But we'll also take that into heart in terms of how we look at this measure moving forward.
It's a bit wonky. I'm always just fascinated. I'm just fascinated with that stuff. So please continue.
Thank you. Key performance measure number eight. It looks at the number of significant diversions with measurement devices installed. And in this case, I've talked at some length about stream gauges, which measure stream flow. In this case, we're looking at a measurement of a different kind. We're looking at the measurement of actual uses of water so that we can understand what's happening within different systems around the state. And this was something that was developed in the year 2000, this significant points of diversion and this desire to measure. And in part, it was in response to the concerns that were emerging at that time around the listing of salmon around the state and the desire for the state to have a better handle on how streams were doing. And so one measure for that is the stream flow gauge measure, just to understand where the stream levels are. But another is to get a sense of the uses on the stream. And so we pulled together at that time the strategy around implementing measuring devices on significant diversions. And these were diversions that were of a significant size, either in terms of the total amount of flow that they were appropriating, or in relation to the size of the, or the amount of flow that they appropriated relative to the stream. And it was also focused on some key watersheds that were identified in partnership with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. So we're not looking at we're looking at a discrete set of diversions here. This this performance measure is looking to have the department implement 175 of these, I believe, on a yearly basis. And I can tell you that we're struggling to meet that standard. When you look at the numbers here, you can see that we're the gap is increasing in between where we're able, what we're able to achieve, and the target that we have. And in part, I would say that's because some of the low-hanging fruit that we've been able to pluck has been plucked off the tree. And to explain that, many of these diversions, or a number of these diversions, the water right holder already had a condition on their permit or was already required to have a measuring device. And so some of our early successes were just following up with those water right holders to make sure that they had those measuring devices. And if they didn't, we would encourage them to install them. Those, I think, went pretty smoothly. The ones that are a little more difficult and take more time are the folks who don't have those requirements or conditions on their permits. And here we are trying to use more carrot than stick with those folks, and having cost share funding, which is something that the legislature helped us with in 2013, it creates an incentive for folks to implement and to utilize these measurement devices. But it's an ongoing process for us, we're committed to continue to work down this path. But we do find over time that some of these water users are more willing than others to engage at that level, and we're kind of hitting that point where our success rate is beginning to diminish compared to where we were in the beginning.
Yes, Senator Hensel.
Well, a lot of that, do you think that I noticed in some of your graphs you adjusted the bars after a leveling off, or that one that was way up for several years and you brought it back down. Is that something you might consider here?
I do think that I think it'd be timely and appropriate to have a conversation about whether the target that we're aiming at is realistic, and we'd be happy to talk with you and staff about whether we might want to look at a more realistic trajectory for that target. Okay. All right, key performance measure number 9. This looks at the percent of water management conservation plans that received a review within 90 days of submittal. Water management conservation plans are required of municipalities and irrigation districts, and they are useful documents for those essentially water suppliers, in the sense that they help you know, commit these organizations to thinking carefully about how they manage their water, how to be ready to deal with emergency situations, whether it's drought or other kinds of emergencies, to develop curtailment plans if they need to, if they don't have the in any given year the water that they might expect and enjoy in a regular year. So it's basically and to start looking at their future needs over time and develop some game plan and strategies on how to meet those needs over time. We receive these plans, and in this case, the measure here is that we're doing timely review of those plans as upon receipt. We've had a strong track record of, as you can see in this table, of meeting the target requirements. We did have a dip in 2013, and in part that was due to staffing. And we were able to meet this obligation on 100% mark, which is always nice to see, because we shifted some staff responsibilities and brought essentially more horsepower to this effort, and that solved it. So I'll leave it at that. Nothing else to add on that.
Yes, Senator Hensel.
That is very impressive. How many reviews were done in that period of time?
I'm thinking 20, but
about 20 a year.
There's about 20 a year. These are fair-sized documents too. They're substantive works, substantive efforts. Okay. Key performance measure number 10. This is the one I've thought about a bit in advance of this meeting, as you can imagine if you look at the table here. This is an area that, quite honestly, the agency struggled with for some time. And I talked earlier about the backlogs that we've had in our certificates and the progress we've been making there. And I've talked about our transfer backlog and the progress we've been making there. This key performance measure is tracking our water right permitting application process and our ability to be able to keep up with our business there. And as you can see, we're not meeting our target, nor are we trending in the right direction. And I want to spend a little bit of time giving you a sense of what's going on and where we're at on that. In part, we are dealing with a situation where we've had, in the near term, over the last couple of years, kind of an unfortunate collision of circumstances. One is that we're seeing many more groundwater right applications come in the door than surface water right applications. And for us, that's a more complex review. It's a much more complex review, requiring staff from our technical services division, hydrogeologists, to do the initial screening and to be able to get a sense of whether the water that's proposed in the application is available from any given aquifer around the state. And again, that's a technical review, and it's a complex review. One of the things that we ran into this biennium is that we had a couple of our senior hydrogeologists, retire right at the beginning of the biennium. And while we were able to bring in some additional staff, that created an obstacle for us and a limitation in terms of our speed of being able to review these. We had to bring the new staff up to speed, and it took some time for us to do that. You know, in addition, relating to the surface water applications that that we had, we also had some staffing issues, a lot of turnover in our application team that reviews applications for permits for surface water. That also created some time lag. We were able to kind of right the ship on that in the second half of the biennium, and we're getting back onto a more regular schedule in terms of moving these through the system. But it did create some problems for us moving forward. Another element that that makes things complicated for us is that the folks who work on these applications also are our frontline staff who help us to deal with drought emergencies. And last summer, and in fact, it's a fairly frequent occurrence these days, we do have droughts declared in different parts of the state. And when that happens, what we often see is some activity among the communities who are dealing with those droughts to get emergency drought permits or emergency drought transfers. There are a number of different tools that they're able to bring to bear to help address their situations. And we need to be able to shift our staff into that drought emergency mode during those time periods, which takes them away from the work that they would otherwise be doing. The bottom line here is that we're not anywhere near where we need to be on this performance measure, and it's something that as I get more time under my belt at the department, we'll be working closely with our Water Rights Services Division, Technical Services Division, and our leadership team to look for ways to improve this process. It's something that as our staff say, and I believe this to my core, there's never a good backlog. There's never a good backlog. It only creates problems for us in the end, and we really need to get a handle on this one, and we'll be bringing to bear all tools that we can to do that, whether information technology or process improvements, but it's something that we're committed to improve on.
Yeah. And how much time, so this is within 45 days of the application filing. How much time beyond that do folks get a review? Would you say, you know, 50% get a review after 60 days, 90 days? I guess what's that range?
I don't have an answer to that. I'll let me, if I can turn around and see if, do you have a sense?
We can look that up by now, but it varies quite a bit.
And then what's the effect of the delay on applicants? I don't really have a good idea about that.
Well, there's a lot involved with any water right application, getting to the final order on an application can be a very long process. Sometimes, and for a variety of reasons, sometimes the applicant will put the application on hold, we could see it be drawn out for some period of time, especially if they find that our initial review response is not to their liking. They may ask for more time to provide more information that could help resolve any issues that there might be. So that's to say that this is yet just a small piece of a much more complex process. So it's not necessarily an indicator of the success of our program as a whole. But it does give a glimpse, at least in terms of the timeliness of the first kind of critical stage of our process.
But what does the effect of that delay have on real life effect for the person who's applying for it? So if I'm applying to you, I'm experiencing a delay. What does that mean for me?
Yeah, that can vary. Most water right applicants, if they understand what they're getting into, shouldn't have expectations that it's going to get turned around in a couple of months. It is probably at best a 6-month process, but can take longer again at times if it's protested or whether the applicant themselves want to have more time for the review. But it can affect their planning. There's no doubt about it. And if an application sits in the queue for a long time, that has an impact on an individual's ability to be able to carry out their game plan, their business plan, whether they're a farmer, a rancher, or a municipality. So we certainly recognize that, and again, that's why we don't consider a backlog to be good, because it does it gums up the works, so to speak, not just for us, but for the folks that we're trying to serve.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you, Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, how many applications did you have in 2014?
I'm thinking 300, roughly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what you're saying is that 20% got the 45-day review, according to your goal.
That's correct. We've got our work cut out for us on this one. There's no doubt about it. Not an easy nut to crack, but we're committed to improve on this.
I just had two quick follow-up questions. Out of those 300, what percent of those are groundwater applications?
About 75%.
75%?
Yes.
Okay. And you were saying that has increased over the years?
Yes.
And then alluded to some solutions to the problem, but I was kind of curious in some of the more details of, you know, how you plan over the next couple of years to reverse the trend.
Mr. Chair, I'm not in a position to give you those details today, not because I don't want to, but I have not had time to sit down with our staff to kind of plot that out, and I'd be happy to do that when I have some time to sort through those. But that is a high priority for me and the agency to work through how we can set some milestones for us in that regard. So I'd be happy to do some follow-up with you when we have some time.
Yeah, thank you, and I appreciate your candor. So, are there any other questions? All right, please continue.
Thank you.
We'll get you back to another good slide here.
Key performance measure number 11 involves the percent of transfer final orders. Now, this is the final order, not just the initial review, for transfers issued within 120 days of filing. And here our target is 30%. And as you can see, we've in recent years been exceeding that target. I mentioned earlier that we've been chipping away at our backlog, which has some impact, frankly, on our ability to be able to do timely reviews of new applications as they come in. We're now getting to what we consider to be a pretty exciting point where we may be very close to be able to put ourselves in a position where we're reviewing applications as they come in the door. And I think as we get to that point, we'll start to see this number go up higher. So we feel like we're on a positive trajectory with this review process. Key performance measure number 12 looks towards efficiency in our field regulatory activities. And I mentioned earlier how important it is for us to have good communication with the water user community, and our water masters out in the field and assistant water masters out in the field are the key points of contact in that regard. And the reason having that awareness and understanding the education of the water user community is so important for us is because, again, there are so many water users out there, so many points of diversion, so many wells, that with our limited staff, we it's very difficult for us to have a handle on all of that in any given moment. This measure looks at the numbers of diversions out around the state compared to the number of FTE that we have. And the goal, the target is to have 2,400 points of diversion per field staff FTE. And we're now at a point where we're at 2,500, essentially, with that. What we want to be able to do is have that bar dip below the target. So it's kind of the inverse of what you typically see with performance measures. But if we're successful in this, that bar will be below the target area, which means our staff will have fewer points of diversion that they would be responsible for. This is a bit of a crude guide in terms of getting a sense of the number of field staff we need to do a good job. But I think it is an indicator out there that gives some sense of the scale and scope of the work that we have and the number of field staff that we have to do it. Water use reporting. This is a wild one. You feel like you're on a roller coaster ride looking at this one. And I'll explain the target, because it's a moving target, isn't it, if you look at that thing. And what I understand, to start off with this one before I go into the content of it, is what I understand is up until, I think, 2013, this target was based on a percentage increase above whatever we did in the previous year. If that makes sense. So you look at the 66%, and then you'll see a bump up the following year. You'll see the 20% in 2009, and then a bump up the following year. You'll see the 27%, and then it's bumped up. The 19%, it's bumped up. So it's these targets are all relative to what we did the year before. But starting in 2013, that performance measure was changed, and it's now looking at 70%. Well, 70% of what? This is looking to measure the percent of water users that have an annual water use reporting requirement that have submitted reports to the department. And the short story here is that that times when we've seen really great compliance with water use reporting in 2008 and 2013 are times when we had staff who were dedicated to working with the folks who had water use reporting requirements to remind them of that responsibility, to work with them, to make sure they understood what the requirements were. These other periods, we didn't have the staff capacity to do that. So it's a pretty simple equation from our standpoint. The water users, they need someone to help them understand what's required of them and to provide some constant reminders around that. And when we have that, we've seen good compliance. Okay, our final performance measure. KPM 14 involves customer service. And here, We're measuring a number of different things. There's on the far left, we have overall performance satisfaction. The second column or set of columns is accuracy. Availability of information is the next, expertise, and then helpfulness, and then timeliness. And it's probably no surprise, based on the conversation we were having on some of the previous performance measures and our backlog issues, that timeliness is one area that where we get a poor grade. One thing I am pleased to see, and I hope that we can continue to move on the trajectory, is that within all of these, we're seeing each of these bars within the different columns represents different years, and so on the far left, 2008, and then moving on a two-year period to the far right, which is 2014. So the good news that this slide tells is that we're moving in a positive direction on each of these areas, which I'm grateful for, and we hope to continue. We are exceeding the target area for accuracy, expertise, and helpfulness. We're close to and moving toward the target in overall category and availability of information. Coming into the agency, I look at this and I think that we're moving in the right direction, and there's a lot to be happy about in terms of the staff interaction that we make with the citizens that we serve. The key area, though, again, is the timeliness issue, and for us, it's really tackling in a meaningful way these backlog issues that we have, and that's going to be a big commitment for us in the coming years. So that covers our key performance measures. And
Director Bauer, we have about, I would like to get through chapter 4 before tomorrow. There's about 15 pages, it looks like. And so if we keep it about a minute, minute and a half per page, that should give us a little time for questions. And in the next, we have about 30 minutes left.
Okay. So I'll do my best to move through this quickly.
Yeah. And if we don't get there, we don't get there. But, you know, it's
no,
a perfect world.
Good to have a goal.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Based on the timeliness. Sorry, it was too easy. It was low-hanging fruit. So
we may have to adjust that last performance measure bar after this.
Okay, good.
So this is an overview of budget drivers for our agency. I'll blow through this slide here pretty quickly because this is a bit repetitive from yesterday, but I just to remind folks, we are the water quantity agency. There's no federal counterpart for what we do. The state controls the distribution of water around the state based on the prior appropriation doctrine, which really emphasizes seniority. The senior users in a system are the ones who have the most predictable source of water in that area. Our agency has been around a long time. The agency was created in 1905, the code in 1909. Don't ask me why it happened in that order, but the water users around the state, many have been using and making beneficial use of water that predates the code by a fair amount. So there's quite a history here with our agency. I won't belabor this either. I mentioned this yesterday, the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. Richard Whitman also mentioned this in his opening remarks this morning. This is the strategy document that was adopted by our commission in 2012. And it really, the key points here is that it sets out a game plan for us and for the water user communities around the state to try to meet our needs over time. And the key elements are understanding the resource, surface water and groundwater, understanding the needs, the different values that we have in different communities, in-stream, out-of-stream needs, what for, and when will that water be needed, understanding the different pressures that are coming at us, whether it's population growth, whether it's changing economic needs, or whether it's a changing hydrograph through climate change impacts, having a sense of how those affect having a sense of those will affect our decision making around meeting Oregon's needs. And ultimately, when you put all those three together, that puts us in a position to be able to make decisions on how to meet those needs and over time. So I want to give you a little context around how things are today. This is actually a product from 2008, and what it does is just kind of give a visual snapshot of how much water is being used, where, and for what purpose around the state. And what you can see here is that in eastern Oregon, these different pie charts represent water use in different counties. The size of the pie, it gives some relative sense of how much water is being used. The color of the slices in the pie give you a sense of what type of use is being made of the water. And this focuses on four uses: agricultural, domestic, industrial, and municipal. Agricultural is green, and as you can see from this chart, especially in eastern Oregon, ag is king, and that's where most of the water is being used. You'll also notice as you get into more populated areas of the state, you'll see the purple slice of the pie get larger. That represents municipal uses, and so the orange represents industrial, and then blue domestic, and it's hard to see anywhere domestic, because that tends to be a fairly de minimis use, often with domestic well use. Those are relatively small uses. So just a snapshot to give you a kind of a sense of the out-of-stream demand and needs around the state. These are the uses, not projected needs, by the way. And overall, agriculture, this slide says 87% of all the uses are agriculture. I think it's in the range of 85 to 87% is accurate statewide. Municipal use statewide is about 6%, and industrial is about 6%. This next slide gives a sense of the demand and use of in-stream demands. On the top left corner is our allocation of conserved water program, which you see has started to kick into gear and have use in the mid-2000s, and is resulting in some in-stream flows being protected through that program. Top right corner is the in-stream lease program. And bottom right-hand corner is in-stream transfer activity. And the bottom line here is just to indicate that we're seeing more and more interest and use of these programs over time, which again just gives a sense that there's a wide variety of values and purposes that water can be used for around the state. So we have these needs, we have these demands. Do we have the water? You know, in very simple terms, our agency and Oregonians are dealing with a supply and demand issue. We all know that we need water, and we need it for a variety of purposes. Is it available is a key question. On the far left here, we have what indicates water that's available for use in August for stream flow water. And in that map, any area where you see kind of the light blue, bluish shading shows where water is available that time of year. And you can pretty much sum it up to the main stem Willamette River area and some areas within the Cascades. Other than that, water is not available out of streams in August. And this, again, is in part designed to protect those existing users on those systems to make sure they have a reliable source based on the data that we have. On the right-hand side, you'll see a map that represents the water that's available for stored water in January. And the blue areas expand quite a bit. Now, as we see water not be available from surface water sources because through our water availability here, folks move into what's option B. And you've heard me talk about how earlier today, even how folks are moving to groundwater. That tends to be the first reaction if they can't find surface water source, because surface water is the easiest way to get water. You know, if a farmer needs water, the best way and the most least expensive way to get water is just to go to a surface water source that's nearby and be able to divert water to meet their needs. If that's not available, secondarily, they tend to go to groundwater as an option. The other option out there, though, and this map on the right would indicate storage as another opportunity. Well, storage can be very expensive. It often will not meet the financial viability test for individuals who are seeking water, but is going to be a key issue for us moving forward. And as I walk you through some of these coming slides, you'll get an impression of why it's important for us to know that there is surface water available for supply purposes in certain times of the year. So I mentioned groundwater, and this map gives you an indication of kind of the relative vulnerability of the aquifers around the state. The areas that are shaded light blue, the geographic areas that are shaded light blue, indicate areas where we think the aquifers are either in good shape or we don't have much data to understand. We just don't know enough. If the shaded areas are in the greenish tone, we have kind of medium concerns about the sustainability of the aquifer levels. And if the areas are that orangish-yellow color, we have high concern over the vulnerability of the sustainability of those aquifers to support uses over time. The bottom line for an aquifer, in kind of most simple terms, is there's inputs and outputs when folks are using aquifers. From a natural standpoint, aquifers exist below the ground, and they're charged over time through precipitation that seeps through the ground and into the aquifers. As people begin to drill wells and appropriate water out of those aquifers, the key question becomes, is there enough precipitation coming into that aquifer to replenish that aquifer after folks are taking water out through their wells? And in those yellowish areas, you're seeing areas where we're not keeping up. Those aquifer levels are not being sustained. The dots that you see represent, and they have different colors to them. The red ones represent declines in aquifers that we've been able to measure over time that exceed or equal to, excuse me, or exceed 100 feet, 100-foot declines in aquifers. That tends not to be a good situation for anybody. And you can see in Senator Hansel's district, and as he well knows, there have been some significant challenges with respect to declines in aquifers there. As we've seen in the Willamette Valley, of all places, you'd think that wouldn't necessarily be the case, but we have issues here. Along the Columbia Basin, the Klamath, the Fort Rock area, as well as Harney and other parts of eastern Oregon. So this is important for us to recognize as we try to meet our growing demands and needs of Oregonians for water, that we need to have a handle on this resource. We need to understand what's available out there, and we need to be able to manage it in a way that's sustainable over time. And so as folks start to move more or move away from the old surface water appropriations, which are no longer available to them, they're moving to groundwater, and we need to be careful that that we manage those systems in a way that makes sure that those existing users and those senior users are able to enjoy that resource over time. Very briefly on this, we do have administrative tools to address aquifers that are in steep decline, and they are they provide varying levels of options for us. One thing that we can do is withdraw an aquifer from further further new uses, essentially, which would then help to stabilize that aquifer and would allow the existing users on that aquifer system to be able to continue to operate. We also have kind of on the far end in terms of severity, we have what are critical groundwater areas, which not only prohibit new uses, but create the authority for the department or our commission to be able to curtail uses and kind of move people out of the priority system into some management regimes that will help restore aquifer levels to more sustainable levels. Not situations we like to be in at all, and these are situations that we want to try to prevent and get in front of, but we do have tools to address those types of situations when they occur around the state.
What? Withdrawn, what does that mean, the third category?
If we withdraw an aquifer, we basically don't allow new uses on that aquifer with the goal, at least for the time period that it takes to be able to know that the water, groundwater levels are stabilizing and more sustainable. Okay. This is a map from March 27th this year, and it shows the precipitation based on the average for the state over this year, the water year that we've been having. And as you can see from this map, if it's a green area, we're looking at 90 to 110% of normal. And in this instance, we're well in the 90% for many of the basins around the state. As you can see in the yellow areas, we're in the high 80s in terms of precipitation, percent of normal, for the water year. That's good. That's a good thing. This map from the same date shows the snowpack equivalent, snowpack water equivalent for these same basins. And remember, we're looking at 90% or above in many of the basins, or in the high 80% in terms of precipitation. But the snowpack has been abysmal. This is not news to any of you, as I'm sure you've been reading in the papers. We've had a very unusual year, a very concerning year. Higher temperatures have essentially eliminated many of the snowpacks that are critical sources of water for the water user community in different parts of the state. And I'll flip back, if I may, to the precipitation map and note in the Klamath Basin, 97% precipitation, and then moving to the snowpack, 7%. That's a horrible ratio and of grave concern to us and many of the folks in the water user community around the state. And the key issue here is that not only does this create a scenario where we have a short water year because of lack of snowpack, but it does create some significant questions in terms of our ability not only to be able to meet the needs in the future, but if this kind of pattern of weather continues into the future, we're going to have a hard time meeting some of the existing needs today, because many water users, especially on the east side and in southern Oregon, where they don't have built storage, have been relying on natural storage. Natural storage is snowpack that's released and melted off of the higher elevations over the course of the summer months and results in stream flows that come through in later times of the irrigation season, for example. And if we find ourselves in a position where we continue to see these high temperatures and reduced snowpack, we've got some significant issues ahead of us. So this next slide shows the scenario that we're seeing today in Oregon is a scenario that's been predicted by climate change studies. I'm not here today to say that this is what we're going to see every year moving forward. I have no idea, and certainly not in my expertise area. But I do think that it's significant that we pay attention to this. Again, in this map, you'll see on the left-hand side in these yellow and orangish areas, these are areas that represent where precipitation typically falls as snow. And that's a pretty broad area. Under a long-term future scenario forecast, you can see those areas virtually disappear throughout most of the state. And again, I don't know if that is our future, but if it is, we've got some significant changes ahead of us that is going to not only make it hard for us to plan for the future, but it's going to really present some dilemmas for us in being able to meet the needs that we have for existing water users today. Earlier today, Richard Whitman showed you an image of the U.S. drought monitor that showed the western United States, and it showed California in deep peril, and that some of these darker hues, these red colors, show extreme drought. And certainly we have extreme drought conditions in Oregon now. Malheur County, Harney County, Lake County, Klamath, and Crook County have all received governor-declared drought emergencies. We're expecting some additional counties to come in and seek similar declarations. What I think is interesting with this slide is this is an indicator of dryness, obviously. But on the far right-hand side, you'll see images from August of 2013 in the bottom right-hand corner. And you'll note that the conditions, the red conditions, are really only around the Malheur County area. And then you'll see above that August of 2014, and you'll see it spread across southeast Oregon. And that it can be year-to-year variability. I get that. What concerns me is when we look at the bigger map, this is March. This isn't the summertime. It's March. And you'll see that red extreme drought classification continues to cover southeast Oregon. Not a good sign for folks, not a good sign for us in trying to help communities meet their needs over time. So this leads to an element of our budget, and I'll talk about this more tomorrow when we focus more specifically on our budget packages. And Richard Whitman mentioned this earlier today. We do have a proposal, and there are a number of elements that are already in the law to help communities address their water supply needs. And what this slide shows is a number of different program areas, but tries to pull them together into a more cohesive unit. What we're trying to build in our agency are the ability for us to be able to provide grants and loans for communities who are looking to put themselves on a positive trajectory with respect to their water supply needs, both now and into the future. In order to do that, we think there are three key elements. One is the ability for those communities to choose to be able to go through a planning process where they would better understand the resource, identify their needs over time, and develop ideas on solutions, and to do that in a collaborative manner, and to bring as many people from that community together and into that conversation as possible. We think that's a smart way and strategic way to go about planning and to have a successful outcome in the end. And part of our budget request is to seek some funding to allow us to authorize us to be able to award grants for communities to be able to engage in those types of efforts. Second piece of this is that once communities have identified potential projects, they need to ground truth them. They need to have some kind of viability review. And we currently have a program on the books and are seeking funding through our budget request for this coming biennium to capitalize that program. This is our Senate Bill 1069 program, and it helps applicants or folks who would receive these funds to be able to do a feasibility analysis to really ground truth the both the physical and financial feasibility of being able to move forward on various projects that they might have in mind. And then certainly last but not least is Senate Bill 839 from the 2013 session, which creates an avenue for project funding. And we're, as Richard Whitman mentioned, we're seeking some additional dollars there for a wide array of projects. And I want to be clear, as Richard Whitman mentioned, we're not just talking about building storage and reservoirs. There's a lot of different things that we can do around the state to help meet supply needs. And some of them are more cost-effective and can be implemented more quickly. For example, efficiency efforts and conservation efforts can take place and are taking place in many parts of the state where we have irrigation districts who are piping their delivery systems, which previously were canals, and which allows for a more efficient delivery system and less loss of water through the delivery of that water. And that creates a win-win scenario for those water providers in that they are able to conserve water, be more efficient with their delivery. If they use certain programs, they're able to utilize some of the saved water for new purposes, as well as commit some of that water to in-stream purposes. You know, other projects that are available under under these resources involve conservation-related projects. So there's a wide array of funding that would be available under this program. There's a lot I could say about this slide, but in the interest of time, I'll be very brief. But there are a number of areas around the state where we are engaged on a regular basis with the local folks, tribes, federal agencies, and other interested stakeholders to work through water issues. We've been spending a lot of time trying to help the folks in the Umatilla Basin address their groundwater declines. There have been some significant planning efforts underway there. There's some great momentum around some projects for on the west side of the basin there with the irrigators, and we're very involved in working with the tribes in addressing their long-term needs as well in that area. The Deschutes is another basin where they've had some significant challenges in terms of the interface between surface water and groundwater. And over the years, we've developed with the folks there a program to allow them to continue to meet their supply needs through a mitigation program. And they're working now on a combination of state funds and federal funds on a planning process that is looking at how they can meet their future needs. The Klamath Basin is an area where great strides have been made. A lot yet needs to be done, but they're positioned, provided they can receive federal recognition and some federal funds, they're positioned to really have a new regime there in terms of how water's managed with an eye toward trying to balance the various needs there. It would be a significant achievement to reach that state. And then the Willamette, an area where we think there's a lot of water, and there is, but a lot of it's tied up behind reservoirs that are operated by the federal government. And we're engaged in a process of working with the Army Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, a number of interested water user community interests at looking at the reallocation of the over 1 million acre feet that are held behind those federal reservoirs, again, to look at how those resources can be balanced between the various needs that we have, whether it's fish, recreation, irrigation, and municipal needs. And I believe I may be close to the end. This is, I'll not say anything other than data is important on this slide. And then we'll be ready to go into the budget tomorrow.
You did a fantastic job, Director, right on time. So do we have any other questions? All right. With that, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
Thank you.